quick little closing bits on hegemony. First, hegemony and counter-hegemony, or what is sometimes called ideological class struggle. So if you buy into this way of thinking about what ideological struggle is all about, it's struggle on the terrain of ideology to challenge the hegemony of the dominant class means you have to create a counter-hegemony. You don't just attack the dominant ideology, you have to re-articulate the dominant ideology. This is indeed a struggle. It's not a simple juxtaposition of ideas. Counter-hegemonic symbols and norms are constantly threatened by reincorporation into the hegemonic ideology, too. So it's a constant struggle to rearticulate and then not to have your rearticulations rearticulated. So an example, Cynthia Costello, who was a graduate student in sociology in the 80s, she did a really nice master's thesis on the way women's liberation symbols of the time were being incorporated into advertising. The most famous example is the slogan for the Virginia Slims cigarettes, "You've come a long way, baby," you know, which would show a woman in some powerful or more corporate or some kind of setting of non-traditional female roles with a Virginia Slims cigarette at the time, and cigarette advertising could still be in magazines and the like. And her argument was that this was a kind of incorporation into the dominant ideology of symbols from the counter-hegemonic cultural forms in the women's movement, and by incorporating them in that way, it also emptied them of their counter-hegemonic meaning. One final comment, hegemony and marginalization. Remember in the discussion of Shavorsky, in the first dilemma that socialist parties face with respect to the electoral struggle, with respect to political struggles, was should we participate or not in electoral campaigns? And it was a dilemma, and you have to take that word really seriously, a dilemma. Dilemmas means that there is no good choice. There's trade-offs. The kind of folk expression is damned if you do, damned if you don't. If you don't participate, you're marginalized. If you do participate, you're absorbed. Absorption versus marginalization. They're both undesirable. Well, generally speaking, there's often the feeling I can resist absorption more than I can resist marginalization. That is, there are counter moves I can make if I participate to maintain my integrity, to prevent being co-opted and fully integrated. So that's a more fertile context for fighting over the dilemma than marginalization. And that's why socialist parties, generally, once bourgeois democracy is firmly in place, they do contest elections. They didn't opt for the alternative route. Well, there's a similar kind of issue involved with ideological struggles over ideology. Because to get onto the terrain of ideology and to start using bourgeois terms that have such strong meanings in the ordinary defense of capitalism, to start talking about freedom and, you know, democracy and prosperity, you know, to use all these terms that are so organic to the established ideological configuration, it does risk confusing things, watering down the oppositional ideology. It may hinge on, if the whole action around freedom hinges on getting people to really understand the distinction between positive and negative freedom, but they're constantly hearing the freedom mantra as being pro-capitalists without the subtle distinction, and they're buying into freedom, well, you can see how there's the risk of absorption, of being deflected from the oppositional ideology. But again, it's a dilemma. I think in the end, fighting on the terrain of ideology over the rearticulation of elements is really the way to go. And it's the way to go also in the sense that when you do have successes, when you do convince people, it's less fragile. People are more likely to be convinced of the alternative in a way that doesn't just dissolve back into the mainstream. Yeah.
So it seems like in the Wolf article that she does make a connection between what you were saying earlier about religion and nationalism. Like, she's saying that Gramsci argued that in order for a hegemonic principle to be successful or triumph over another one, it's not that it's inherently logical in the way that it's constructed, but that it has to become some sort of national religion and bring them kind of this emotional effect. And I talked about this collective will that is really, can you, like,
yeah, I didn't, that's a part of the argument. The collective will part I never quite understood. I think the national religion idea, one way of thinking about it is if you've successfully incorporated oppositional elements and you've rearticulated them in this way, if you can then anchor the articulations in this hot way with nationalistic symbols. So this has to do with the connection between a hegemonic ideology and a hegemonic culture. Remember, I broached the distinction between ideology as organizing the beliefs and culture as organizing the dispositions. So that has more to do with this emotional side. I guess the way I would think about it is that that's what blocks the rearticulation. So if this way of organizing these ideas is also anchored in these emotionally charged symbols that makes people's blood boil and their passions rise, that acts as a psychological barrier to the rearticulation of elements. And that, in a sense, becomes a way of stabilizing the hegemonic form. I think that's what she's meaning. Now, whether that means if you're doing a counter-hegemonic project of trying to rearticulate these elements, you also have to anchor your rearticulation in hot emotional symbols in the same way to block their corruption by the dominant articulation, you know, whether there really is symmetry on this, I don't have a comfortable position. I like to hope that not. You know, my wishful thinking is that the left can be more rationalist, can build the strength of its commitments on the basis of people's understanding of the ideas and their tolerance of ambiguity. You know, partially what really understanding these ideas are is that you understand there are ambiguities, not certainties. What a stable ideology does is give you certainties. Well, that's, as I've said before, there's the tension within Marxism between functioning as an inspirational ideology that gives people courage to struggle for a distant future versus a scientific framework that promotes skepticism all on every step of the way. Well, those are two different kinds of configurations. And I mean, I hadn't thought of it this way, but maybe the main difference between those two configurations is precisely the way the ideas get anchored or not anchored in a set of emotional commitments. So that may be, and that may be this national religion kind of metaphor that Wolf is using too. That's an interesting thing to think of, as to whether this really is symmetrical. Maybe so, and all the worse for the idea of a rational alternative as the grounding for struggles against systems. All right, let's turn to legitimation, the normative dimension of ideology. So there's two kinds of issues I want to talk about. What's the relationship between legitimation as a specific aspect of belief systems and other aspects of ideology, and in particular the connection between legitimation and mystification, two issues? And secondly, how do we understand the process by which these normative structures are produced and reproduced and transformed? How do we understand their dynamics? Okay, so first, the normative dimension of ideology. This is, I think, the most common sense notion of ideology. Ideology as an ism, as a systematic worldview that contains values and norms, notions of what's good, bad, right, and wrong, and connects these, the ism of ideology. Ideologies understood as isms have as this core a set of beliefs about what's good and bad, right and wrong, and then connects them to beliefs about how the world works. So it's the connection between the what is, what exists, and what is good components of ideology. That's the standard, I think, way that people think of capital I ideologies. How are these connected? Well, one connection is that mystifications help to support legitimations. The belief that the United States is a just and good society, this is a normative judgment, that the United States as a particular way of organizing our institutions is good, is desirable. It's closely related to the claim that there is in fact opportunity for advancement and that failures are individual faults. So the land of opportunity description of what exists is connected to the legitimation principle that this way of organizing people's lives is good and desirable. The land of opportunity is the mystification part because it's a gross exaggeration of the connection between a person's location in the society of birth and their possibilities. But it helps to anchor and support the legitimation. But there's some independence between these, since the belief that individual outcomes are what matters, are what is important rather than collective outcomes, is a normative premise which does not logically depend upon any given account of those outcomes. You know, so you can have the belief that what matters is individual opportunity rather than the collective well-being of people. That belief, what matters, the moral core, is individual opportunity, and the inequalities don't matter as such. It doesn't matter if some people suffer and some people don't, so long as there's equal opportunity. That belief is independent of how much suffering there is. And so there's a certain autonomy between the mystification aspect and the legitimation aspect, even if they're connected. That's the first point, though, is mystifications help to support legitimations. The legitimations are more stable given the confusion people have about the way the world works. Legitimations also can obstruct demystification. Beliefs in the American way, in individualism, in competitiveness and manliness, these are all beliefs about what is good, right? They're the part of the normative dimension of ideology, beliefs in individualism and competitiveness as desirable. These become obstacles to people seeing the real determinations at work in social life. What is often called socialization or indoctrination or propaganda, depending upon the context, centers on buttressing the normative ideological supports of an existing society, which in turn blocks struggles against mystification. So if you really believe in individualism, that makes it harder for you to see the way in which people aren't responsible for their own fates. That is, if you believe in individualism as a normative ideal, not as a description of how the world works, but as a normative ideal. You know, people should be responsible for their own fates. They shouldn't be dependent on others. It's a dog-eat-dog world, individualism as a moral ideal. If you really are committed to that, it makes it harder for you to realize that people aren't in control of their own fates, that it's social institutions which are shaping whether or not people succeed or not. And random luck has much more to do with individual outcomes than individual effort. Those demystifying aspects get blocked by the strength of the legitimation principle, the normative aspect. And I think I would add, and sort of add as a result of the way we've been sort of talking about it today, that the way in which legitimation blocks demystification in part is because of the way the legitimation aspects get anchored in emotions. The what is good, what is desirable aspects, that's an aspect of ideology that is going to, at least has a higher chance of having this very strong emotional anchor. So it makes it a hot belief, not just a cold belief. And that's what then acts as this interference with arguments that shows that the world is actually different. Here's an example, running through an example, the individual competitiveness. So I think there are three normative beliefs that constitute what we call individualism. So I'm talking about the normative face of individualism, not the explanatory face. So in social science, there's what are sometimes referred to as individualistic theories, which basically are trying to explain social phenomena by the attributes and actions of individuals. That's within the ideological realm, that would be an aspect of what exists. It's what exists includes how do you explain things. I'm talking about the normative beliefs. So here are three normative ideas. First, it is good to compete with others, to try to be better than others. That's a desirable thing to do, to try to be better. Not all cultures endorse that. It may be a little bit apocryphal, but it's often said by anthropologists that in Hopi culture, being better than other people is seen as undesirable, and to be observed as being better. So in the kind of classic story that's told is in high school track meets involving kids from the Hopi reservation with kids from the Navajo reservation. The Navajos don't have this particular cultural form. The fastest runners on the Hopi always stop short of the finish line and let other people pass them. They don't want to win. Well, that's pretty strange from an American normative point of view. But it's a belief that it's fine to develop your athletic potential. It's fun to run fast rather than slow. You know, so there's nothing in the culture that denies the development of your talents. It's just the public display of superiority is seen as a violation of collective solidarity. So the kids were brought to these races because that's what the school system thought they ought to do, and it was very uncomfortable for them to engage in that kind of competition. Well, that's a normative issue. Second, one's worth and status is defined by how well one measures up against other people's performance. That's a close cousin of the first point, that it's good to compete with others. But it has an independent notion that how worthy you are depends not upon how well you've actualized your own abilities, but how well you stack up against others. That's a pervasive normative issue in academic life, of course, and very difficult to rid oneself of that view. So as a professor, I am fully committed in terms of my formal beliefs in the idea that what I value is students realizing their capacities. And that the purpose of my feedback and my criticisms of your papers and whatever is to help you improve and do better work, to realize your capacities. It's very tough, though, to not compare and to see the worth of one person's performance as defined by the quality of other people's performance. And that's based on, I think, a normative understanding of where status and worth comes from. And a real egalitarian, a kind of radical egalitarian normative order around human flourishing fights against that. Some psychologists think of comparative evaluation as hardwired. It may be. You know, it may be that as primates we are hardwired to have status systems in which it is relative status that matters, not absolute realization of some inner capacities. And it may be, therefore, that just as vegetarians are fighting a hardwired part of our biology to have a taste for animal products, we do. We're omnivores. And a vegetarian says, no, there's reasons why you should fight against that particular hardwiring. So the fact that it's hardwired that we may be status seekers and status comparers is neither here nor there as to whether it's a good thing. Just because it's natural doesn't make it good. And I think egalitarians generally recognize the destructive consequences of a strong belief that value comes from comparative value rather than realization of individual potential. Okay, but there's a second. I'm just laying out the normative beliefs that constitute strong individualism as a cultural form. First is competition. Second is status comes up from comparison. And the third is rewards that come from individual competition are justified and desirable. So it's not just that individual competition is good, and not just that your status depends upon comparative value, but that extrinsic rewards that come from such competition are also desirable. So it's fine for somebody who's better than someone else to get paid more. There's nothing morally suspect about differential pay for differential contributions based on differential ability. All three elements are important, and they all help to legitimize capitalism as a social order. So capitalism as a way of organizing our economic affairs is strengthened to the extent people strongly hold all three of these views about individuals and worth and competition. Well, then the question is, how do we explain the prevalence of these beliefs? These beliefs are pretty widely shared. They're not the only beliefs people hold about these values. People have complicated and inconsistent beliefs. When you ask undergraduates, what do you think about the distributive norm to each according to need, from each according to ability? That's a radical violation of this third point, right? A third, apparently, of freshmen in the United States think that that comes either from the Declaration of Independence or the U.S. Constitution. Now, the reason they have this crazy view is because it does correspond to a kind of ordinary moral view about how, if you're living in a community of people, you'd like people to live. You'd like them to all have their needs met, and you'd like them to all contribute to according to their ability. So it sounds pretty commonsensical. Well, it's a deep violation of individualism. To each according to need, from each according to ability. So how do we explain it? I'll just quickly run through this. I'm not going to go into an elaborate discussion here, but one kind of explanation is just straight indoctrination and socialization. Children are taught through role models, televisions, all the media stuff that you hear about, hero worship, that competitive individualism is an ideal to aspire to. These ideas are implanted in the minds of people through symbolic manipulation and indoctrination. That's the kind of strong view, that it's the message is explicitly transmitted to people through various kinds of cultural forms that fill us with these ideas and give these ideas their power. A second kind of explanation, this is a mechanism that we'll be talking about on Thursday when we look at the micro psychological foundations of ideologies, is cognitive dissonance. People see that cooperation and more collective forms of social and economic interaction are unattainable, that the society makes it difficult to do it, and if you can't get it, it must not be good. So cognitive dissonance says that certain things which you might value, when you can't actually live them, you then devalue them. A third argument centers around what could be called character structure or personality or other ways of thinking about the non-conscious aspect of subjectivity. This is what psychoanalysts would emphasize. So Freudian approaches to ideology say it's not so much the inculcation of the beliefs as such which matters, but the formation of a particular kind of personality structure which anchors such beliefs. In discussing fascism, for example, and the norms and values which fascism supported, in the post-World War II period, one of the strong theories behind this was what was called the authoritarian personality, and which was, in its kind of extreme psychoanalytic forms, had to do with early childhood rearing of a highly disciplinary character in German households. It's been largely discredited as a way of thinking about these things, but it's still, there's a kind of kernel of an idea that's worth thinking about, which is that there are certain people who are susceptible to fascist-type ideologies, not because of the content per se, but because of the form of the ideology. That is, the absolute obedience to a leader who knows what's best. And that's the authoritarian personality. People who have that underlying disposition are then vulnerable to whatever the content of that authoritarian ideology might be. And so in some contexts they become communists, in other contexts they become Nazis. It's the same underlying personality structure. Obey a leader is what is the personality. An obedience-oriented personality. There's other versions of this which I think are actually quite useful. In the 1960s, the 1960s was of course the period of the most publicly visible struggles against racism in the United States, the 50s and 60s, and social psychologists were working on the psychology of racism as a major theme. I think that's not as central in social psychology now. Racism is now treated more as an attitude rather than as a full psychological complex. A distinction was made by Thomas Pettigrew in discussing racism between two kinds of racists. Racists who were simply conforming to whatever the conventional norms were about race, and racists who were more organically racist, that is, it resonated with something that was more deeply part of their dispositions. The behavior might be the same in most contexts. They would both follow the racial codes, they would both enforce them, but some were doing it just because everybody else was doing it, and some were doing it because it really felt good. It's the way they wanted to be. It was their way of being in the world. Now you can see if there are these two kinds of racists involved and you're in a process of struggle over transformation, the ratios between these two is going to matter a lot. If most people are just conforming to whatever is the dominant norm, and then you can, through struggles, change the rules of the game, you can enforce different norms, then they're likely to conform to those pretty quickly. Once they figure out, okay, we're in a different world, from now on blacks are going to be in school, that's the way it's going to be. Once they're convinced that that's the way it's going to be, they're not going to fight it. Whereas if you're an organic racist, it is perpetually an affront to your dignity to be in the presence of African Americans, and therefore your resistance and your subversion of those norms continue. I think that's a pretty important distinction to make on all of these ideological issues and the questions of ideological struggle and transformation. It has to do also with this hot and cold versions of the ideologies. The conformist has a cold version and the organic racist has a hot version, so it's fueled and anchored in emotions in a different way. I think this is a pretty important kind of issue because it really does affect the context in which you're trying to change people's views. If you're confronting a mass of organic racists versus a mass of conforming. Yeah.
So is that like a biological innateness that they're saying that these organic racists have then?
I don't think it's usually thought of as biological in the sense that you're born with it, but it is sometimes thought of as anchored in some neurobiological, psychological process. the content that gets infused in that would be cultural and contextual, as in the authoritarian personality story. So an authoritarian personality, in the absence of either fascism or communism as kind of authoritarian ideologies, you would see that sort of person as just somebody who slavishly follows the rules in their workplace and who does whatever the boss tells them to do because you obey authority. So the authoritarian personality would behave in ways very congenial to authoritarians, but it wouldn't have an ideological consequence. Yeah.
So I'm sort of seeing a distinction between the person who internalizes the rules of the game, and like that would be what creates an organic racist, is like somebody who's like really attached to like the way that things are.
So it depends upon how you elaborate that expression, internalizes. So the conforming racist may have internalized the rules in the sense that they really know them well and they don't have to think about it and they just do it by habit. So it's fully internalized in the sense that they don't have to consciously say, oh yes, now I'm gonna have to behave this way because that's what the racial codes say. So I think both organic and conformist racists have in some sense internalized the rules of the game. But in one person, those rules are anchored in something that makes them much more part of the underlying dispositions of the person, with much more emotional weight, so that when they are around blacks, they feel disgust, rather than just feel uncomfortable because it's somehow violating their expectations. Or they feel hatred. So disgust and hatred are two negative emotions that are very powerful, you know. Whereas other people may feel anxiety. So if you're a conformist and you're in a situation that's violating the norms that you normally conform to, it makes you uncomfortable. You feel anxious because you don't know quite what to do. And so you avoid such situations. But anxiety is very different from hate and disgust in terms of how it anchors those beliefs. I mean, that's how I would. So internalized is fine, it needs further elaboration in order to know what the mechanisms are that's really in play in this contrast. Those are three. Indoctrination, cognitive dissonance, and other cognitive issues we'll talk about. Character structure. And a fourth kind of explanation for the prevalence of particular norms are just social practices. Competitive individualism is reproduced because the material practices of everyday life constantly validate it. It makes it adaptive for people to hold those norms. It punishes people who violate it. This is what Terborn emphasizes in his discussion of affirmations and sanctions. The affirmations and sanctions are just built into the ordinary everyday practices of life. They're constantly affirming the individualistic norms and sanctioning the failure to follow them. When you enter school, the micro practices are imposed on you to reproduce norms of individualism, regardless of your character structure. So some people who are not particularly competitive, that's not their inner way of being. They're not aggressive towards others. They kind of want to get along and, you know, be easygoing. Nevertheless, they can learn to act in competitive ways because they do want to be successful. They understand that getting good grades and going to good colleges and so on, that this matters in their life. They understand how the affirmations and sanctions in the world go. And so even though their inner dispositions aren't very comfortable with this, they learn how to play the game. And that's because of social practices. So all of these, I think, play a part. I don't see any reason you don't have to choose between these. I think these are four kinds of mechanisms in play. It is important where the main action is. It's important where the vulnerabilities are. So if you want to change a set of norms, if you think that the beliefs in what is good and desirable are one of the obstacles to social change around social justice issues, and so you want to change them, well, it's good to know how these things work and to try to figure out where the points of entry might be for transformation. But I don't think one needs to pick and choose in some abstract way. Time. Okay. I think I'm going to skip the next item on coercion, consent, and norms. I mean, there's interesting things to say about the particular articulation of consent and coercion, but I'd like to, since I went to the trouble of putting these nice graphs on the back of your outlines, let me just go through this as an example of the problem of transforming norms. And I'm going to use a gender norms as an example for this. So the whole premise of this is that ideologies matter, that the beliefs people have and they hold matter. And if we want to transform the world to make it a better place, one of our tasks is to engage in practices which have some effect on transforming people's beliefs. And this, in particular case, we're talking about of norms. Exhortation is one of the ways of doing it. You can, you know, have movies, propaganda, theater. You can have all sorts of cultural practices which illustrate and enact and perform alternative norms, and this can have some effect. But sometimes what is needed is to somehow change the conditions under which people in their daily lives fight over norms. So one view is that a lot of social change occurs in the micro settings of everyday life, around gender, in families, when men and women struggle and fight over what are the norms that are going to regulate our behavior, that's going to decide how we should each behave, how should we each, you know, the should in how we behave. And people fight about that all the time. What's sometimes called, in literature, the battle of the sexes. A lot of the battle in the battle of the sexes is over norms. How clean is the house going to be? Who should do what? Who should be responsible for what? Are you doing your fair share? I mean, all of these things are the stuff of cultural change played out in the micro settings of life. So one view about how you change norms, including, in this case, norms around gender, is to ask yourself, are there ways you can affect the terms under which people fight those battles? Rather than how can you directly change norms, how can you affect the conditions under which people change norms themselves through their own practices? So here's one way of thinking about this. I've worked on this context, on this set of issues, in the context of my work on care work. I mentioned that I was in New York for this meeting on care work. So particularly around things like child care. And one of the issues has been, do alternative systems of parental leave, where people can take time off from work, are there different ways you can do this? It's organized in different ways in different parts of the world. Do these have different consequences on the way people fight over the norms? So that if we want to create a more egalitarian division of labor and sense of identity and roles in the micro settings of people's lives, are there some rules of the game for parental leaves which make it easier to move towards an egalitarian set of norms than other rules of the game for parental leaves? So that would be a case where you could have a public policy changing parental leave, which has consequences for how much housework husbands do. So if we want an egalitarian distribution of housework, it's unlikely that you'll ever be able to get it by passing a law saying men need to do as much housework as their wives, and we're going to have a housework police to enforce this. No, that's not the way to do it. The way to do it is to maybe change some of the parameters in which people then fight over that issue. Because that's the context in which I've been working on this. So there are three facts about the world as it is. There's a behavioral fact. Women are much more likely to take care of young infants than men. That's a simple descriptive fact about how that labor is distributed by gender. There's an ideological fact about the world. Both men and women generally believe that women ought to take care of children more than men, and that women are more nurturant than men. That's a commonly held belief by both men and women. That is, it's not a male belief that women are more nurturant than men. It's a belief held by both men and women that women are more nurturant than men, that men are not as, in terms of their basic nature. That's a kind of essentialism that both men and women hold as beliefs. That's an ideological fact about the world. And then there's a dispositional fact about the world. Whatever the gap in underlying dispositions towards nurturance, whatever is the underlying character of it, that is the actual disposition to be nurturant of men and women, the underlying gap is smaller than the behavioral differences. That is, whatever is the, we don't know what the underlying distribution of dispositions towards nurturance are. We can't observe that. But what I would state as a fact about the world is we know that there's less dispositional difference between men and women than behavioral difference, because the world conspires to force the behavioral distributions apart. So the basic idea then, the basic underlying argument here, is that the first two of these facts reinforce each other. The behavioral and the ideological facts reinforce each other to block the translation of dispositions into behaviors. So one possible world is in which people's behaviors match their dispositions. The most nurturant people in the society do the most nurturing. The least nurturant people do the least nurturing. That would be a match between people's underlying dispositions and their behaviors. The combination of ideology and actual behaviors blocks the translation of dispositions into behavior. So one way of changing the system would be to disrupt the behavior through strong incentives to get people to behave differently. That would then weaken the ideological component. People's belief that women and men ought to do these things will change as a result of the behavioral changes that people observe, and this would unleash the dispositions. So one way of looking at that is through these charts here. So just to show you how to read these. So the first is the world with strongly differentiated and effectively enforced gender norms. So to say that there is an effectively enforced gender norm, what that means is there are adverse consequences to people who violate the norm. They can be of various sorts. And I see that the 12 o'clock group is here, and I have told them that when they come, we should stop. So what we will do is we'll spend the first few minutes on Thursday wrapping this up. You can puzzle over these little graphs and figure out what they mean.